I grew up in a Christian family, but I didn't really feel that it added anything that was very useful. Like sermons, they'd give you like a feel-good message, but a lot of other like self-help or other stuff like that can give you the same thing. Plus, I find it hard to reconcile what I learn in like science with what the Bible says.
On this edition of the White Horse Inn, we're in part two of our series on questions of faith.
Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the White Horse Inn. In this program, we have a special guest sitting in on the panel with your usual hosts, Greg Kokel from Stand to Reason. Greg, thanks again for being
with
us.
Yeah, a lot of fun.
We are now going to go directly to the on-the-street interviews Shane Rosenthal once again has done for us by going to university campuses and asking some of the basic questions that we will be interacting with on this program related to questions of faith and reason.
Do you think that something can come from nothing?
I would say no.
In that case, the current reigning theory of the origin of the universe is the Big Bang, and that everything in the universe simply came into existence from nothing. Do you think this is an exception to the rule that something comes from nothing, or do you believe that that idea sort of points to a creator?
Well, I'm hardly a scientist, and I would argue that we hardly have a full view of it now, but it's tough to say that the Big Bang argues that something came from nothing, as opposed to everything came from something really small, but then where did that come from? And even the existence of a creator would argue that the creator itself came from somewhere. So to say that it's an exception to the rule is in itself a very tricky question, because it's a tough subject.
First of all, a question to throw out there. Hardly a scientist, so there's this assumption that because we're not scientists, we really can't answer these questions. Let's hand this over to the experts. And then we don't have the whole of it. So do we have to be a scientist, and do we have to have the whole of it in order to make a judgment here?
I think sometimes this particular issue is made much more difficult than it actually is. And when I talk to people about this, I say, you don't need to be a scientist. You don't need to be a philosopher. We all understand that the universe came into existence, and that would be everything that we know about, the natural order, the physical stuff, the laws, all of that stuff.
Forget for a moment how it came.
Yeah. It all came. So then where did it come from? And they say, well, I don't know. I'm not a philosopher, a scientist. I'm not a specialist. Wait, there's only two options, from something or nothing. That's the only two options. Now, you don't have to be a philosopher or scientist to answer whether it's most reasonable to think that the universe popped out of nothing for no reason, or rather that it was caused by something adequate to the task, capable of producing this effect. Again, that is a simple, straightforward question, doesn't require a PhD. A high school kid can figure this one out. No, it seems like the odds-on favorite is something caused it, not that nothing caused it.
Well, to his credit, the young man was not willing to say that something came from nothing. And so the initial answer that he gave, did something come from nothing? He says, no, that can't be. But then he says, he tried to reason by saying, but if there's a creator, then where did the creator come from?
Infinite regress.
I think he's trying to put too much into the answer. If we stop at yes, then there must be a cause. Mm-hmm. Now, what does that cause or that creator, what must he be like? That's a different discussion altogether. But let's begin where he begins by saying, no, nothing can come from nothing, or something can't just come from nothing, unless there is a source.
I'm not surprised, Ken, that he made that comment, though, because this is the same comment that every one of these new atheists make in response to cosmological arguments. Well, then who created God?
Yeah.
This came up when I did my debate with Michael Shermer, and I was ready for it. I said, Michael, you don't believe God was created because you don't believe in God. Hmm. I don't believe God was created because I think he's eternal. Nobody in this discussion believes that God was created. So why are you asking us the question, who created God? There is nothing about our view that requires us to answer that question. But there is something about the naturalist view that requires them. And that is, they believe the universe came into existence. That's a whole different kettle of fish.
And isn't it a whole different kettle of fish now that modern science, contemporary science, for the first time perhaps in the history of science, believes that the universe is finite? I mean, here the philosophers and scientists were all at one for the great centuries of our civilization on an eternal material world. If anything, science in the last 100 years has made that completely untenable. So aren't we in a better faith in science kind of world now today?
I know that the Big Bang is, say, controversial with some Christians, but it just seems to me that even if for the sake of argument we accepted their evidence, that works on our side. And what's really interesting is to watch how from the very beginning, when Einstein figured this thing out back in the 30s and he saw the implications of it, how he tried to run from the implications. And everybody since then has been working hard to run from the implications that the universe had a beginning, that the whole natural order came into existence at some particular point of time. And this has metaphysical ramifications. And again, that doesn't take a PhD in philosophy to figure that out. And they're running so hard trying to come up with all kinds of crazy alternatives to the obvious question that something, some personal being who is powerful and outside of the natural order and outside of history and time and the like was responsible for this creation. But that sounds too much like God to them. So rather than going with the odds on favorite, they're betting the whole show on some infinitesimally small possibility that God wasn't necessary for this event.
You know, isn't it the point, especially today, where people can't be faulted? The people Shane's talking to on the street themselves have not heard arguments, even if they were raised in the church, very likely they haven't heard arguments. They only heard arguments when they got to university. And they were bad arguments, many of them. So, I mean, some of them were good arguments, even if the conclusions were bad. And they never heard the arguments for when they were growing up. So we've got to be really thoughtful and sympathetic to people we meet like these folks we're hearing from, don't we? It's a conversation. We need to enter into conversational apologetics, not just sort of from on high.
So that sounds like a softball you're throwing to me here since I wrote this book on tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions. And many times in shows like this, when you're talking about the ideas, we're kind of shooting out rapid responses to show that we've got these areas covered. But we're not intending people to respond to other human beings by firing out rapid fire, rat-a-tat-tat, the answers to their challenges. What I'm counseling for and what our habit is here in personal life is that we're engaging people in conversation. And the tactical approach is to ask a lot of questions. We can use questions to test their own reasoning. So instead of saying, you know, I think there's a, essentially, I think there's a problem with your thinking here, we could make the point by asking a question.
So they arrived at their own conclusion.
Well, they're kind of pushed into a corner, but in a gentle way. And We try to focus in on more of a genial diplomacy so that this engagement looks more like diplomacy than D-Day. Now, I mean, if you look at, if the other guy gets mad at you, you lose. If he's mad, you lose. If you get mad, you lose. You don't want to get mad. You don't want to draw lines in the sand. You don't want to get people defending their turf. So even though in some of these questions that we're going to be dealing with here, we might be firing out the individual, here's where they went wrong kind of thing, that isn't the best way to maneuver with them. If you want to know the best way to maneuver with them, well, you're going to have to get the tactics book, I guess.
It's a great book. It's an absolutely great book.
My shameless plug there. But just think about asking questions and think conversational, sharing the time with them. Let them do a lot of talking. You'd be surprised at how often when you ask a person the question, they give what I call the Simon and Garfunkel response. It's kind of like the Sounds of Silence, something that they have.
I've never thought about that.
Well, yeah. Where even if you ask them what they mean by that, they sometimes have to take some time to think about it. And what this gets them doing is thinking more critically about their own view. What do I mean by that? Why did I come to that conclusion? What are my reasons for it? And let it play out. Let them talk. And that relaxes the whole conversation, but you'd be surprised at how much progress you can make with that relaxed attitude.
Great point. With that in mind, let's listen to the next response.
How do you account for the apparent order and design that does exist in the universe? For example, if there isn't a God, then how do we have brains that can reason if it was created from chaos? How do you know that your reasoning works well if nothing created it, nothing designed it? I mean, if we had a computer that was created out of tornado, would you trust it to calculate data? So why do you trust your own reason and rationality if it's just the result of chaos?
I actually don't know. I just believe in, like, humans are different from animals. We can think. We have a, I don't know if I'd call it a soul, but just something more.
Now, Shane's question kind of shifts from the argument for cause to the argument from design. This makes it a lot more complex, doesn't it? A lot of burden really does fall on the atheist or agnostic here, because now you're not just saying you have something from nothing if you're an atheist, but that you have this particular implausible confluence
order
of billions of components that all fit together.
And sounding like the Scottish common sense philosophers, it's self-evident that humans are different from animals. These things that he's up against, human rationality, you don't have to think about it. You just use it to think about it. Mm. You have rationality from the beginning. You know, just on your interaction with the real world, which you encounter the real world, it's self-evident that humans and animals are not the same, that humans have the ability to reason in a way in which animals do not.
I think it's interesting the way he started, though, in response. He's stymied for a moment. I presume there was already a prior commitment he'd made to the idea that the universe did look designed, and then he couldn't answer that. But he said, I just believe. Now, it's just so curious, because this is what the Christian is being faulted for doing, for just believing. Now, if I were in this conversation, I'd want to draw him out a little bit more on that, not to accuse him of making a leap of faith, because I actually don't think he's making a leap of faith. I think, as Kim has pointed out, that this is there's a self-evident principle here. We are different, and this is pretty obvious. But then this leads to another question. In what ways are we different? What makes us different? And why are we different in that way, given the naturalistic view of the universe? And that's my question for him. Now, I want to draw him out a little bit and see how he struggles with that. And then I'm listening, because I don't know where to go after this until I hear his answer. That's the conversational element.
Let's go to the next question.
If you're an agnostic / atheist, how then do you account for order and design in the universe?
To be honest, I can't account for that, but I think neither can anyone else. I think that we live in one speck in a speck of a giant area. I think that it's kind of arrogant for us to say that at this point in time in our history that we can fully account for a creator of all of the universe. I don't think that it's fair for us to put it on ourselves to be able to explain all this right now.
Wow. How do you...
If somebody were going on the beach and they noticed a footprint through the wet sand, they would properly conclude that it was made by someone with a foot that shape walking along the beach. They wouldn't be tempted to think some kind of convergence of natural processes produced this thing that just happened to look like a footprint. Michael Shermer made the complaint to me in my debate with him that we see patterns because we're pattern-seeing creatures. I said, well, yeah, we are pattern-seeing creatures.
Why?
Well, that's the part of the question, but that doesn't mean the patterns aren't there.
Right.
We're not manufacturing the patterns. We need this to survive. This is a case, this agnostic atheist, it's a case where when it comes to something that is against his view, he's just punting to mystery and saying, well, we can't even get into that. Why can't we conclude that something like the DNA double helix, which is thick with libraries full of information, probably were designed by an intelligent being. Why is that somehow out of play? That seems to the most obvious. And why would that be arrogant, for goodness sake? Notice, and this is another move. And by the way, these are the questions I would ask him. This is another move I see a lot. If you make a claim to have an answer based on the evidence you're concluding, then somehow you're arrogant?
Right.
Yeah. Because you've come to that conclusion? How does that fit?
And back to your footsteps analogy in the sand, isn't he basically demanding that before you can make any judgment about footsteps in the sand, you have to know everything about all of the beaches in the universe?
Yeah, like, all right, who was it walking? Well, I don't know who it was. This is kind of
like, let's just start there.
Who designed the designer? Well, right. All I can tell you is that this looks designed and I have good reason for it. I don't have to tell you anything about the nature of the designer to know that this has been designed. That's a different question. We can talk about that, but I don't have to answer that second question in order to answer the first one. There's nothing about arrogance that is in play here. This is just careful thinking about simple things. However, once again, this guy's an agnostic atheist. He doesn't want to go there, so he's
going to change the subject.
He's changing the subject.
Yeah, and he kind of hides it in a subtle sort of way by saying, well, I can't fully explain it, and therefore no one else can either. Ooh. So boom, there it is. It's not going to be explained.
Next question.
If a tornado went through a junkyard and made something like a computer, and you knew that this was created by happenstance, would you trust it to calculate your data and keep your files?
Probably not, because it's a tornado.
But if the chaos produced your brain, why do you trust your brain to reason through any issue?
That's actually a very good question. I've actually thought about that, and the reason is because what's the alternative? Is the alternative I just don't trust anything I ever think? I do things with trepidation, like I perceive I'm driving, and I perceive cars coming, but I don't know.
Well, the issue is, does your worldview have the ability to account for rationality itself?
Well, I suppose a lot of that lies in just general consensus, because to me, logic is somewhat universal. 2 + 2 = 4, and you can explain that to someone who's never heard of math. It's an empirical, objective form. To me, it's just a matter of general consensus that everyone's brains kind of work in that same way. I've lived 19 years, and it's working out so far, and that's kind of the best I can say.
It's funny that he says a general consensus, and then he uses the word universal. I mean, sometimes you can look around and see what people generally acknowledge, and then this is a hint that maybe they're all on to something real.
Did I hear him correctly say that there's a general consensus that our brains work? And would we make a general consensus that everyone's brain works?
Yeah.
I had a guy once at Berkeley when I lectured there. I asked him, just trying to find some foundation, I said, let's just take 2 is the square root of 4, right? And he said, well, that's what my culture has taught me to believe.
Oh,
yeah.
And
Lewis,
I said, wait a minute. Stop. I said to him, we can't go any further until we get this straightened out.
Right.
Don't you believe that 2 is the first? That's what my culture. Do you know what 4 means, right? You know what 2 means, right?
Yes, yeah.
You know what square root means, right? Regardless of how you happen to learn it, can't you just see that that's the truth?
Right.
Even if your culture says otherwise? And then he says, that's what my culture has taught me to believe.
C.S. Lewis illustrated one time with a woman who said, you only say 2 + 2 = 4 because you're a man.
Well, you know, Richard Rorty, for example, famously made that argument. Everything is the result of conditioning. But the person we just heard from said that we perceive, we can know our perceptions. Now, we're getting a little technical in philosophy here, but basically Immanuel Kant, we can know our perceptions, but we can't know reality. Mm-hmm. I can know that I am perceiving a tree, but I can't know treeness itself. Regardless of what you think about Kant and his ideas, the next move is to say, I only see treeness because I'm a white middle-class American.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that is...
that's where we're at
basically
now.
Basically where we are.
Yeah, I don't want to miss Shane's original point with the question, because I think it's really, really good as we're thinking strategically maneuvering. He's asking a question about worldview. You acknowledge this feature of reality, the use of rationality. You have a worldview for which that feature of reality has no place. You can't get traction in your worldview to explain this. Now, this calls for a worldview adjustment. Because if your worldview does not match up with reality, that's evidence that your worldview, at least at that point, is false. You want true worldviews. What worldview makes sense of this feature? That's the strategy in play there, and I think that's a fabulous strategy to press people on. Francis Schaeffer used this all the time as well.
The next few questions deal with the question of morality.
Do you agree or disagree with the idea that might makes right?
I generally disagree with that.
Why?
Because the idea of might makes right just means that whoever's strongest is right. But I think there's a difference between being right and being the strongest.
So then what is the basis of right if it's not connected with power?
For me, I generally do not enjoy when someone who's stronger than me or whatever attempts to push their values upon me. That to me is something that is wrong.
So some people argue it this way, that there are no absolute rights and wrongs. I can't say what Hitler did was wrong. I can only say I don't like it. Do you agree with that philosophy, or do you think there's a different way to define that what Hitler did is actually objectively wrong?
I think that objective right and wrong is a very tricky thing. I usually think of things as being inherently subjective. I personally don't agree with that, but I tend to draw the line at causing someone grief. That to me is... like, it's a subjective and objective measure kind of at the same time. So I think it's a case-by-case basis.
I have to say, I really hope we don't have another Hitler come along anytime soon.
Wow.
This conversation shows the abject confusion that people have in their minds when they try to talk about morality. Might does not make right, but that's just the way this basis for me, I do not enjoy. So now he's back grounding things utterly subjectively. So he's bouncing back and forth in this subjective-objective confusion. And God bless this guy. I'm sure that he's a very bright guy in many different ways. He was talking somewhat clearly, but when you look at the concepts, there was massive confusion, showing he's never actually thought about this issue. Other than saying, I don't like people imposing their views on me, and I think that's wrong. But what makes it wrong? Well, because he doesn't enjoy it. But why should anybody care about what he enjoys?
Right.
Well, and what struck me is that even after Shane asked the question, what about Hitler? And he said, I personally don't agree with that.
Yeah. Now, he tried to backtrack.
How would you
get
the Nuremberg trials?
Yeah,
how would you,
of course.
How would you get this universal sense that justice needs to be done to those who perpetrated the Holocaust with a bunch of people who were trained at Harvard Law School today saying, I personally don't agree with that?
Yeah. He seemed to backtrack a little bit towards the end when he said, yeah, I crossed the line when you're causing grief. And I guess causing grief is an understatement of what Hitler did. But I noticed something else that's interesting, and I think this is a lot of Christians miss this, that when he says, I don't believe that anybody should be forcing their values on me, that's kind of when they crossed the line. That was kind of his minimalist ethic, absolute ethic there. What a lot of folks don't realize as this statement that you shouldn't be forcing your values on other people is itself a statement of values.
Sure, right.
So when he declares that in that way, he is expecting others to obey his particular value system. In other words, he is forcing that value on other people, doing the very thing that he says shouldn't
be done.
The thing
that was overwhelming to me in the whole thing was the question of whether he represents a whole generation that's lost confidence in any kind of objective analysis of anything that has to do with ethics.
Yeah. Well, what seemed to be pretty clear is that the individual subject is the standard by which everything else is evaluated, so that he is denying any objective authority or any objective truth.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's listen to the next question.
Do you believe in the idea that might makes right? Or is morality, what's right, rooted in something else?
I definitely don't think the government should tell us what to do. I think we should enlighten ourselves and try to figure out what feels right for us and work from there.
Some describe that way of thinking as emotivism. In other words, Hitler isn't objectively wrong, I just don't like what he's doing. Would you agree with that idea, or do you think that he is objectively wrong?
I think when you hurt others, then there's a point where it's just like to be human, to be a good human, which is subjective, but I think there's such a thing as when you can be like definitely wrong, and I guess that's where the law comes in.
How do you ultimately say that Hitler is wrong? Because if the religious person gets to say it's not right according to the one who created everything, but for you, it's subjectively not right, but Hitler gets to say, but it's right for me.
I see what you're saying, and I really believe in, like, everyone has a view of whether their actions are right or wrong, except psychopaths or people like Hitler. They might not have that, like, in themselves, but in general, most people, if they're born, I guess, normally, you could say, they have the internal compass of right and wrong, so that's where you can say something is right or wrong.
I get the same impression with all of these people that I listen to, Mike, and it's not just with these, but when I have conversations with people, and it's a funny combination. On the one hand, they're virtually all knee-jerk relativists. That is, when they start responding, they respond relativistically. And this person actually said government shouldn't tell us what to do, for goodness sake. Does he vote? I bet he does. Well, isn't he trying to vote for somebody to tell everybody what to do? And that's a different issue. But deep down inside, I think they're common sense realists. And that's the image of God in man that's coming out. When you listen to these conversations, you can see both points of view battling with each other.
Yeah. Mm.
You see the relativistic statements, and then you see these little glimmers of objectivism that kind of bleed through because they can't do otherwise. They still are human beings that God has made. And what you end up with is a mass of confusion.
Sure.
It shows how poorly people have been taught. This was done, I think, at university locally, and a prestigious one, as I recall, in the University of California system. But even these people are incapable of talking intelligibly about something as weighty as morality.
Yeah, and as you point out, there's a collision here of two tectonic plates, the image of God and their suppression of the truth and unrighteousness. Mm-hmm. One of the examples is his statement that only psychopaths don't have a sense of right and wrong.
Yeah.
Now, that would have been interesting to follow up on. Now, why would you say that? Why would you say that only psychopaths don't have a sense of right and wrong? Because now he is turning into an objectivist. Mm-hmm. Oh, and in fact, if you don't believe in objective right and wrong, you're a psychopath. Right.
Teleology. Something's gone wrong. You're not working the way you're supposed to work.
Yeah.
Well, it's I find it interesting at a very simple level how few, none of these people have responded with immediate outrage at the example of Hitler. They've tried to qualify their disgust with what he's done, but at the same time leave it open so that they're not making judgments, I guess.
Because they know where it's going.
Exactly.
They know where the question's leading.
You know, I wonder if we ought to retire Hitler for these kinds of illustrations and instead use something like Matthew Shepard. Now, Matthew Shepard was the homosexual young man who was killed 8 years ago now up in Montana or Wyoming, somewhere there. Everybody knows the story. A documentary was made about it. Of course, everybody that's on the left who are given to these subjectivistic, relativistic statements, we're quick to judge what happened to Matthew Shepard because this was a hot button for them, homosexuality. You start relativizing their issues. Well, that changes the game entirely. Was it wrong what those men did to Matthew Shepard? If so, why?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's a great point. And two, again, we get what feels right.
Yes.
People don't talk that way about scientific claims or historical claims, but when the moment you get into aesthetics, ethics, or religion, the switch flips from thinking to emoting.
Yeah.
Next question.
I don't think might makes right. I think that's absolutely incorrect. That's just the whole thing, that a government can make laws simply because people will break them.
So if it's not might makes right, what is that wrong is rooted in?
Certainly, I think there's an objectivity to what is right and wrong. Certain actions you can't quite view in the same light as other actions, whereas you might think, you know, it could be passable in some cultures, but then again, not. I think that there's kind of a universality to certain things that you can't do, murder for one thing.
But it's common in the animal world, so why is it wrong for humans?
Well, humans, you have to understand that we obviously transcend beyond the animal kingdom, beyond, even though we're part of it, you have to understand that we're not quite animals.
What explains that, though?
What explains that? Just that we have powers of our own action, that we're not so much driven on instinct and hormonal aggression the same way that beasts are.
I think this is the most intelligible response we've seen yet. He's acknowledging that morality is objective. He is saying that some things depend on cultures, and I'm willing to say that there are some cultural elements to some of these things, but there are foundational issues that are universal. And when pressed on how that can be, this is the grounding question, well, he goes deeper and he says, because we're not animals.
Exactly.
We are the kinds of creatures that are moral creatures and have moral responsibilities. And we have the capability of making choices, which powers over our own self. And this is something that is necessary to make morality meaningful. Now, he didn't go deeper. I mean, you still keep asking, well, why are human, what grounds that in human beings? But I think that he's digging deeper.
And certainly deeper than the earlier responses.
Well, the earlier responses were just all over the map. This seemed to me to be much more coherent. And I think the guy's moving in the right direction as far as it went.
Don't you think, too, that like a lot of people, there is the statement, I believe that there is objectively right and wrong. But epistemologically, in other words, how do I know that? They're relativists. It's not that there are a lot of people out there who really, they have to believe that what great, horrendous criminals do in history is objectively wrong. But once you get to the question of whether we can make judgments about that, people become subjective.
See, I would have switched the order, and maybe it's because I'm misunderstanding here, but I would have said, here's a guy who epistemologically, because he has tools that allow him to see things because God has made him that way, he can get the right answers about things, but he can't explain why the grounding question, why those things are right. But and I think this is a great tool that we have. Sure. People can know what the truth is. Just like Christopher Hitchens can say, look, I can be just as moral as you could be. That is, I can follow your same sets of rules. That's like a guy saying, well, I don't believe in authors, but I can read as good as you. I could even read better. I said, well, yeah, you might be able to read better, but you would not have anything to read unless there were authors to write. That's the grounding question. I think human beings, made in the image of God, can get the right answers because they have epistemological tools, but they can't make sense in their metaphysical worldview, and there's the ontology, of why the world is the way it is, why human beings are different from animals. He gave a quantitative assessment, because we can do these things, but why is that better? Why are we different in an exalted kind of fashion? That's the grounding question. That's the ontological issue, it seems to me.
Yeah, I don't think he had, like you said, Greg, I don't think he was able to fully explain, but it seems as if his position came from a consistent worldview. He had an understanding that man is not an animal. He couldn't explain fully what makes the difference, but he at least had that category.
Next question.
Are you a religious person?
I am not.
Why not?
It's just essentially what I believe to be true, and I generally base my theory of the universe based on evidence more than just faith. I have religious friends who've tried to explain faith to me, and I honestly wish it was something that I did have, but it sounds pretty nice. But faith seems to me to be it's been described as a feeling that you don't need objective proof because it's just something that you know inherently. It's something I don't share, but more power to the people that feel it, you know?
What do you think draws people to cling to faith?
I think it's a couple things. I think in a large part, it's family. If it's something you're raised in, it's something that you're very much predisposed to. And I think for a lot of people, it's really comforting to not have to constantly question everything and to just have it brought to you and just, oh, well, I have my life figured out. This is comforting for me. Now I can go live. I can do other things. I don't have this constant, oh, what's going on in the world?
How do we respond?
Well, I think he shows some basic flaws that probably have been inherited from either bad secular arguments or bad defenses for the Christian faith. One is that faith somehow is in contrast to evidence. It's everything that we say faith is not, that it's blind, that it's not based on knowledge, that it's not based on assent or trust. And so he's putting faith and reason in conflict where they don't need to be.
I wish I had it, he says. Faith. I wish I had it. You think, okay, now let's, the analog here is a person with whom you're close. Let's say your spouse, or in his case, let's say a girlfriend. This is someone that you've come to love? Yeah. Well, do you trust her? Yeah, I trust her. Do you have reasons to trust her? Oh, yeah. I mean, we share everything, and, you know, there was a time back there where I felt like I was being taken advantage of, and she saw it, and she didn't let it happen. No, there, I could tell you time after time where she earned my trust. Oh, really? You'd never ask that person, do you trust this person? And he'd come back and say, well, you know, I wish I had it. Either you trust somebody or you don't. You have a reason to trust someone or you have a reason not to trust someone. But when it comes to God, people go irrational.
Right.
A switch flips. Right.
This is a good case to make to Christian parents everywhere for a couple reasons. One is so that your kids, when are asked questions by people like this guy on campus, don't tell them that faith is a feeling.
Right.
And don't communicate improper things to them that only push them away from the faith. And the second thing is so that your kids understand that there is a comprehensive Christian theology that does explain the kinds of things this guy is wishing he had answers to. And if you instill this in your kids from day one, they're not only not afraid of something that doesn't fit the box that they've, you know, checked, but they do give coherent answers to questions when asked. This poor guy, you just almost wish you could stop and, hey, we need to talk here. We can really help you, I think, with some of this.
Yeah, faith is not a thing that you either have or you don't have. The way it's understood here or assumed, it seems, is that faith is something that makes up for a lack of evidence.
Exactly.
That faith is actually trusting someone who is trustworthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, last time we talked, you mentioned a book I'd written called Faith Is Not Wishing, and that's the title essay in a series of essays there. And this is exactly the point that I'm making. We often have the perspective that what faith is kind of a spiritual wishful thinking. Mm-hmm. There is no objective element to it, and this is quite the way this man understood it, because when asked, how do you get this kind of feeling? Well, you kind of get it from your family. If you're raised that way, then you kind of absorb it from your environment. You're socialized into this. There was no suspicion that conviction had anything to do with objective facts and evidence. None of that came forward. Instead, it's just, well, your family gives it to you. And he actually was sympathetic or wished that he could have that same thing himself, because he thought it brought a level of comfort, which I do think it does, but on one level. But I frankly don't know that many people who have never questioned their own convictions. You know, people of spiritual conviction still can have doubts. This happens regularly, and so it isn't like you get there, you get this thing, and then you're magically set for life. That's not realistic.
And if you do have this view of religion as basically subjective, obviously the thing that you're going to miss if you don't have it is therapeutic. It's personal, subjective, therapeutic. Whereas if you're talking about Jesus being raised on the third day to bring into being the new creation, to save history from the Hitlers of the world and from the me's of the world, to save me along with it, that is of public significance once again.
You know, the early Christians,
therapeutic.
The early Christians did not go to the lions and to the massive crucifixions that they did in those first 300 years of Christian history, because Jesus was delivering therapy to them. They were willing to put their lives on the line because they believed that a man named Jesus of Nazareth had done something on a Roman cross that made a difference, and he sealed that by rising from the dead 3 days later. Is there therapy in that? Well, yes, but it's not just therapy. It's not even grounded in therapy. It's not a therapeutic moment. Mm-hmm. It might have therapeutic impact.
Because it's bigger than that.
It's bigger. It's grounded differently. It's not about that. Mm-hmm. Regardless of how they felt, out of fidelity to Christ, they still go to the lions because they know as a fact of reality based on the evidence, the work of the Holy Spirit in their lives, this is actually true.
Next question.
I'm not really religious. I grew up in a Christian family, but I didn't really feel that it added anything to my life that was very useful or that I couldn't do myself, especially like sermons. They'd give you like a feel-good message and they give you a self-empowering message, but a lot of other like self-help or other stuff like that can give you the same thing. Plus, I find it hard to reconcile what I learn in like science and my belief in like the theories of evolution and all that with what the Bible says.
Perfect example of what happens when moralistic therapeutic deism takes over the church.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I don't feel it added anything useful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You listen to a sermon, you feel good. You get some self-improvement or self-empowering kind of message.
Why can't I get that from
yes,
the street?
I can get
those
from somewhere
plenty
else.
Of places. Yeah. So this man understands religion as kind of a social club that is meant to help individuals, not as a point of view that reflects reality. I ask this question a lot of Christian audiences. I said, if somebody were to ask you, what is Christianity, what would you answer? And there's a couple of different options. But the right answer to that is that Christianity is a view of reality. We are not offering up a club here that will give you some suggestions on how to live better or provide you with friends around you and fellowship or companionship or those kinds of things. Those might happen, but that's not what it's about. It's about discovering the way the world actually is and then living consistently with that, in our case, under the authority of the King of the Kingdom. Yeah. The Lord himself.
Who rose again to prove that he's the King of the Kingdom.
Did you notice the progression of that argument, though? To make your point, Greg, he starts by saying that religion didn't offer anything helpful for him, and then he talked about the bad sermons. And so, therefore, he says, it had nothing to give him to understand science.
Yeah,
so that's where he is.
Important point.
Yeah.
You know, this is the irony of our times. People are saying, well, we've got to be relevant and practical, meet people's needs. And what we're hearing people say is, I left because you were doing moralistic therapeutic deism, when actually, if that's all you've got, I can find that elsewhere. I don't need to show up at 9 o'clock every Sunday morning. But if you have something for me, if you have something that can kind of make me stop in my tracks and reevaluate the world.
Yeah.
I'll give it another shot. There are a lot of people saying, okay, I'm waiting. Nope, still nothing. Still nothing from you guys.
You know, this is what happens in churches, it seems to me, Mike, that take the accounts in the Gospels, for example, and they make metaphors out of them. So we have Jesus calming the storm. And then they say, this is how Jesus can calm the storms in your life. What's curious is the disciples didn't respond that way. They didn't say, Jesus calmed the storm. You know, I have some storms in my life. I wonder what storms he could calm.
Point.
No, what the disciples said is, who is this man who commands?
They're more afraid of him than they were the storm.
That's right. And they bow down and worship him. And so instead of transforming powerful teaching in the New Testament into life-transforming lessons for people as we see the person and the work of Christ, very simple, the person and the work of Christ, what we've done is we've tried to make it relevant and applicable by metaphorizing the text and therefore losing its power.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, folks, you're seeing, as if you didn't already before this program, that there are more interesting conversations out there to be had. We shouldn't give up and shrug. These are dear neighbors made in God's image. We should care about engaging with them, and we should care about knowing what we believe and why we believe it, to be prepared to have a reasoned argument for the hope we have when we encounter people. We're going to continue interacting with these On the Street interviews in our next broadcast with the help of Greg Kokel.
I'll be here.
Thanks again for being with us. And thank you, listeners, for being with us again on The White Horse Inn.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. To find out how to support our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also check out the support tab of our website at whitehorsein.org. That's whitehorsein.org.